The Theosophical Society presents Gordon Plummer in a talk entitled Spiritual Powers and Psychic Phenomena.
And it is very much in my heart to speak of some aspects of the occult side of this work, specifically to dwell on H.P. Blavatsky and what she actually was, and also in the nature of the great teachers that we speak of as the avatars, because the knowledge of these things is very important to us and really has a very close connection with our work. But it will be necessary to lead up to this, first of all, by indicating that there is a vast difference between psychic and spiritual powers. And from the earliest years of the Theosophical Society, many people who are psychically sensitive have been attracted to it. And that is perhaps natural, sometimes from the belief that this is theosophy. Sometimes the study of theosophy has quickened a person's psychic sensitivity. And I think that in past years, there has been an emphasis upon psychism and psychic activity, which has gradually worn off. I'm inclined to think there's less emphasis on it now, and that in itself is a very good thing. I would say it's a good sign, because if the emphasis can be drawn away from psychic phenomena to knowledge, that would be the very best thing that could possibly happen to the Theosophical Society. Now, I'm not going to dwell on the nature of psychic powers, because this is already known to you. You can list them, of course, as clairvoyance and clairaudience and various types of manifestations and apportations and whatnot. This is already familiar to you. And I would like to think that there are realms that we could explore tonight which will sweep you right out into a grand vista, and you will see where these other things take their place. But it'll almost be like looking back down a long road and looking at things that once interested you, but now that you would find would be relatively unimportant. And I'm going to, first of all, give you an illustration, because you've probably learned by now I like to give word pictures, and they will sometimes convey an idea much more forcefully than 15 or 20 minutes spent in explanations. And I would like to indicate, of course, that a certain scientist I want to mention is not living now. But in our discussion, that isn't important. We can imagine that he is, and that is Albert Einstein. Probably, he knew more about the nature of gravitation than any man living in his time or since. There are some who have carried his theories farther and perhaps developed some formulas that he himself was not at that time aware of. Nevertheless, he stood head and shoulders above all the thinkers of our day, and he was more conversant with the nature of the gravitational energy than anybody else. The other person I'm going to put side by side with him in this word picture is a tightrope artist, or a high wire artist at a circus. Now, it might be said that Einstein had a great theoretical understanding of gravitation, but the tight wire artist has a certain practical application of the law of gravity. He does not understand what he's doing. He could not give you any of the formulas that Einstein can, but on the other hand, he could do something that Einstein never could. He can walk a tight wire and dance and perform some very wonderful feats on the high wire. And so he is using applied knowledge of gravitation as against the theoretical knowledge that Einstein had. And yet, let us ask which gave more to the world. The high wire artist can give you an afternoon's thrill, and he can make a whole audience gasp in amazement. And when you come home from the circus, of course, you're talking about it with your friends and telling things that you hardly believe that you saw. But except for the thrill of a day, there's little in value. And he is soon forgotten. But the world will never forget Albert Einstein. And Einstein's theories are not so impractical after all, because without them, space travel would not become a reality as we are finding it today. Atomic investigation would never have been carried to the point that it is were it not for Einstein's equations. So we must not think that Einstein was completely impractical simply because he could not walk a tight wire, simply because apparently he did not have practical application of the law of gravitation in his own bodily sense of balance. Well, now, practicing psychic powers is something like the case of the man on the tight wire. And there are some interesting results which can be attained, and I dare say there is a large number of Theosophical students, as well as many outside of the Theosophical Society, who have practiced some psychical powers and experienced some phenomena. And if we realize that is much like the case of the tight wire artist, who can certainly produce something that makes people sit up and look, nevertheless, it does not actually have any lasting value. And as we pursue the matter this evening into the nature of spiritual power, you will see the difference as being as great as that between the tight wire artist and Albert Einstein. Now, we have to consider, in the nature of man, his various energies or powers, which we have listed as the seven principles of man. And you know them, of course, as well as I do. Atma, Buddhi, Manas, Kama, Prana, Linga, Sharira, and Stula Sharira. Or using the English equivalents as well as we can, the universal self in man, the inner God, and the spiritual intelligence, that which is really the teacher within, the higher self, and then the mind, which in its higher aspect is linked with the teacher within, that which we call the Buddhi, so that the higher faculties of the mind are illuminated by spiritual intelligence. Then there is the lower mind, which is governed by desires, the kamic, K-A-M-I-C, the kamic influence, that in which centers the desires, the lusts, the passions, the emotions, and so on. Then there is the life principle, or the prana, as we call it. And then the astral body, which, as it were, is the blueprint or the mold around which is built the physical body. This is just a very brief enumeration. As we pursue the studies, we learn that these seven principles cannot be separated. They cannot be studied as though they were things apart. But the understanding of each one involves an understanding of all of the others. And we learn that prana is not something which is unique and in a pigeonhole, as it were, or a compartment, but it is something which is penetrating the whole of the nature of man. Prana acts on all of the planes of man's consciousness. So does his spiritual life. So does even the kama, because the kama has its varying grades of activity. And we find that just as the radio waves of all of the stations on the air interpenetrate this room in all points of space within this room, so that you can tune in on the stations wherever you may have a radio, in the same way, the various energies of man are all interpenetrating and working together. But each of these may be thought very properly as a source of energies and faculties which are peculiar to their own nature, so that the physical body has its own faculties, its own function, and the organs of the various senses, the senses themselves are really astral, working through the appropriate organs of the body. Then there are higher centers, and these are perhaps not so well known, and they shouldn't be really studied too carefully, too much in detail, until we have something of the higher knowledge anyway. They may be briefly spoken of as the finer forces or the chakras of our natures. But then there are the faculties of the mind, which are just as intriguing and just as interesting as these other faculties. There are the faculties of the spiritual nature. Now the psychical faculties arise in just that portion of our being which we may call the intermediate self, the psychological apparatus, if you like. And this in itself may cover a fairly wide range, the emotional nature, the psychical nature, but it is limited. And even though a clairvoyant can apparently see through a wall and know what is going on into another room, and a clairaudience can hear at a distance, and there is thought reading, nevertheless, these psychical faculties meet an impassable barrier in what we commonly call the akasha. The akasha is really the higher levels of the astral light. The astral itself is not one simple thing, but it has many grades, many levels, if you like. That is something that could perhaps take a whole evening study. You may have some questions on that. But the highest reaches of the akasha, where the akasha merges into the spiritual, is an absolutely impenetrable wall to the psychical faculties. But the spiritual faculties very readily go beyond into the spiritual realm. And that is why we are going to spend time in investigating them this evening. Now, I want to be quite specific about one or two things. And one of these is something that I'm sure you have studied. And H.P. Blavatsky refers to it in The Secret Doctrine as the third eye, or the eye of Shiva, and it probably has other names too. Now this third eye is something that is really very important to all of us. And it is an organ which was more prominent, more in evidence in the earlier races of mankind, and has become much more suppressed in modern races because modern life is not conducive to the development of the third eye. But the third eye is really the organ of the intuition. And the intuition in this case means much more than hunches. It means the faculty of taking knowledge from within. That is the true intuition. And the study of theosophy is one of the best means possible for developing the faculties of the third eye. And this should not be confused in any sense of the word with psychical faculties. It, in its real use, has no bearing at all on clairvoyance or clairaudience or the other psychical faculties in the ordinary understanding of the word. We will learn, as we discuss this evening, that an adept or a Mahatman must certainly develop his psychical nature. But that is a somewhat different story, and we will come to that. But the third eye, when developed, gives a student the faculty of knowing, the faculty whereby he sees in the teachings that have been given to us, he sees in them windows or casements opening out into grand vistas, and that a simple teaching such as we have of karma or reincarnation is only the first word. It is actually only the beginning of knowledge on these subjects. And when we give our talks to the public and we speak of these, reincarnation and karma and the other things which we feel are suited for public use, we should know within ourselves that there is a vast body of knowledge which is attainable. And we do have some perception of it, but not nearly enough. And the development of the third eye is just that faculty which enables us to understand the teachings in a vastly greater way than we ever have before. And as we do this, then we learn that the right use of the psychical faculties is in the nature of servants to the spiritual faculties. The psychical faculties are actually dangerous if they are practiced as if they were things in themselves, as if the development of psychical ability is an end in itself. Then it becomes dangerous. But when we realize that the psychical faculties are the servants, and more than that, we can say they are the outer fringes of the spiritual powers, then they begin to take their right perspective. They begin to fit into place in our natures and the place to which they properly belong. Then they can be brought under control and they can be used with full knowledge. Too often, people drift into psychic ability. They drift. They do not understand what they're doing. And one of the first rules of training is never allow yourself to drift into anything. Whatever you do, do it with knowledge. Do it with willpower because you understand what you're doing. But never drift. Now, this third eye that I've mentioned is only the beginning, actually, of the story. But we speak of it because it is something that each one of us has. As far as the physical organ is concerned, it is the pineal gland, as I'm sure all of you know. And it is one of the highest centers of the body. There are other centers, but we need not discuss them tonight, because it takes us into realms of study that are highly esoteric. And actually, we are not prepared to understand them. It may be that some students have them in a tabulated form and have the names for them and to some degree their correspondences, but that is not giving any real practical knowledge of them. The practical understanding, so that these energies can be directed and used, comes to the adept, not to the student. And I'm going to draw the distinction, if I possibly can, between a student or a chela, disciple, and a teacher, because it is in the understanding of the difference that we see where the spiritual powers actually come into our lives as realities. One reason the spiritual powers themselves are so little understood by us is that we have not yet developed the faculty of really understanding them. But there is something that we can grasp, and we can grasp the beginnings of an understanding, just as when we speak of karma or reincarnation, we are understanding the beginnings of these teachings. Now, let us see what, first of all, is the difference between a pupil and a teacher. What is the real difference? A pupil is one who has, first of all, perhaps through a series of lives, discovered that within himself there is a great yearning to know. He finds an ever-increasing delight in studying the teachings, and he finds an ever-increasing desire to share these teachings. That is the first sign that he is on the right road. And he does not want to accumulate a great body of knowledge for himself alone. He feels there is little point in his learning unless he can share. And that is a good sign also. And so when he asks for knowledge with the idea of giving it to others, imparting it to others who are as hungry as he, then he is giving the right call. He is giving a call that will be heard and that can be answered. And as we find it so beautifully expressed in the Bible, knock and it shall be opened unto you. And that is the real meaning, that if a student knows how to ask for knowledge in the right way, he will not be denied. Now the time comes when, with the awakening understanding of the pupil, he learns that theosophy, or the ancient wisdom, is more than book learning. It becomes experience. It becomes a way of life. He understands what is meant by the expression, theosophy must be a living power in our lives, because that is just what it becomes. And as he grows and develops along the path that he has chosen, he finds that he becomes a beneficent force among his fellow men. He actually is becoming it gradually. Then new awareness comes to him. He becomes aware of the fact that there are those who know more than he, not only because of reading in books, students who are perhaps older and wiser than he, who have studied longer, but let us take the greatest books that we have. And I always go back to The Secret Doctrine and other writings of H.P. Blavatsky and the Mahatma Letters. In reading these, he feels the vitality of the authors of the letters. He feels the vitality of HPB. He comes closer to them in actual awareness through their teachings. And he finds that the printed page is something that is alive for him. He becomes aware that there are those who understand much more than he, and he becomes filled with a desire to know more about them. And then it occurs to him, and perhaps others who have had the same experience tell him, that it is possible to dedicate himself to their work. And he resolves to make his life a period of service, with the hope that future lives may be a continuation of the same thing. He learns how to pledge himself. And when he finally learns how to pledge himself to the point where there is no turning back, where never again can he be what he once was, then he is a disciple in the true sense of the word. Then the time comes when he actually learns to know his teacher. But even so, he is still a learner. He is a disciple. And he is allowed to learn the alphabet of the language of occultism. And here I'm using occultism in the highest sense of the word, as representing spiritual power. He learns the language. He discovers that the great teachings that he has mastered about the nature of man, the place that man holds in the universe, the marvelous structure of the solar system, the relationship between the planets and himself, the fact that all of the planets of the solar system are planetary chains, and the wonderful relationships and interrelationships between the globes of these planetary chains, all become an ever-increasing delight to him, because he discovers that in these things he is learning the language of occultism. He finds that there is a wonderful law of correspondences. He learns finally that those portions of himself that he has called the seven principles are directly related to elements in the universe from which he has drawn those very energies that have made his constitution what it is. He discovers that the secret of esoteric astrology, which goes so much deeper than fortune-telling and horoscope-making, the real secret of esoteric astrology is man's consciousness in its deepest reaches. And those deepest reaches take him out into a knowledge of the relationship between the different elements within himself and the planets themselves, because he learns still greater things, that the teachings of death, where we have studied about Kamaloka and Devachan, are only the beginning. The story is far from told. He learns that that part of ourself which enters into the Devachan, those blissful dreams of death, which seems so real to him, is that part which is learning and growing. But he discovers that there is something much greater, much deeper within himself, that does not need the Devachan. It is far beyond it, and it goes out in the adventures of death awake. It is much like the case of a child that is asleep in the arms of its mother, and his mother is going through the stores in town doing various errands and shopping. The child is completely unaware of what the mother is doing. The child is asleep. But the mother knows what she is about. And in the same way, then, we learn that that part of us which enjoys the fruits of the Devachanic bliss is like the child that is asleep in the arms of the higher monad, that which we call the Atman, and the spiritual monad. He discovers that these higher parts, which transcend the Devachanic state, have a sublime and glorious adventure in death. And he learns the part that the planets of the solar system play in this magnificent drama. All of this, he finds, is part of the language of occultism. But still, he is only a disciple. And whereas he seems to have progressed far from the point where he was as only a beginner, nevertheless, he is not yet ready for practical occultism. He is not yet ready for the exercise of truly occult powers. He has long since learned to give up all psychical practice. He doesn't need it, because psychical practice never brought him to the point where he is now. He simply doesn't need it. His objective is to get knowledge of himself, of the universe, of mankind, of man's destiny, the causes of human suffering, what can be done to lift the heavy burden of suffering from the world. These are the things he wants to know. He wants to know what is that wonderful bridge that he must cross. And having crossed it, he becomes a teacher in his own right. And before his feet are at that bridge, he has learned something of what that bridge is. We call it initiation. There is so little that is known about initiation simply because we are not ready for it. But this he finds out, because we are following him in imagination, and it is a very fine exercise for us to do this. It helps to quicken and to whet our appetites for these things. Following him in imagination, he has long since become aware of his teacher. He knows his teacher because he is taught. He has found that the teacher that he has discovered has one chief objective, and that is that the student will find his own inner teacher, because for him there is no teacher that will ever stand so high. And the first secret of discipleship he learns is that he must constitute himself a chela or disciple of his own inner teacher first. And having done that, and having learned to place himself in an attitude of reverent listening before his inner guide, his teacher, he then develops within himself the faculty of recognizing the outer teacher. That is the secret. And he has learned this. And having then learned to listen to the voice of his own inner teacher, having developed the faculty of taking knowledge from within, he learns then also something of the secrets of initiation. And his guide, his teacher then, informs him carefully of all that he is to expect. He knows that to become a Mahatman is the most difficult thing any human being can possibly undertake. He learns that. He learns that initiation is the most difficult feat that he can possibly enter upon. Absolutely the most difficult. And he learns the occult meaning of the expression, "Give up thy life if thou wouldst live." And as a slight relief from the rather concentrated thinking that we're doing right now, I'm going to give you another picture which will kind of relax your minds for a moment, but will nonetheless bring home a point very, very forcefully. At home, I have a night blooming cereus, and it may be that some of you have this plant also. It's a very, very beautiful plant. when in bloom. And during the time that it is not in bloom, it is just a very drab olive green color. It belongs to the cactus family. In itself, it is not a particularly beautiful plant. It does not have very beautiful foliage. But once a year only, it blooms for one night. And we see these buds appearing. And they take many weeks to develop. And they grow gradually larger and larger. And every evening we go out. We went out into our patio. We expected, when will it bloom? Will it be tonight? It almost looked as if it would. Finally, one evening, we knew it would bloom. And actually, this had four blooms on it. Those blooms were so beautiful, we called our neighbors in to see them. Large white blooms, the purest white that you can imagine. And the fragrance was absolutely heavenly. And what a lesson that was to me. Out of that drab plant, out from itself, this marvelous bloom was brought forth. And for only one night. In the morning, it was gone. And we must wait another year for another bloom. And I could not help thinking that the process of initiation is like that. While we are preparing ourselves, as we are humans with all our faults and our failings and our weaknesses, we are not very lovely to look at. But we await the time of the blossom. And the initiation is that wonderful process whereby the pupil brings forth from within himself. It is nothing conferred upon him. Nobody can confer initiation upon anybody. The student must bring it forth from within himself. And what he becomes after initiation is as great in comparison with what he was as this wonderful bloom of the cactus is to the cactus before, during all those weeks while it was preparing to bloom. And there isn't a single one of us who has the slightest idea what we are really capable of. We haven't even begun to realize ourselves. But following this pupil in imagination as we are doing, putting our eyes forward on the path, following him in this word picture, we see that the bud of his spiritual self has taken form, it is taking shape. Then, as he learns the awful mysteries of initiation, and it is a thing not to be lightly dealt with, he is guarded from it. He is not allowed to go into it until the teacher is absolutely certain and sure that he is strong enough to go through it. And when the time comes and the teacher knows the time is right, he is guided to the very portal of initiation. And then he is left alone. And he is absolutely and completely on his own. And he must go forth into the inner realms awake, not asleep as in death. But he learns by first-hand knowledge what are the great mysteries of death. And there is the secret of the story of the crucifixion and the resurrection. It is all a mystical story. The crucifixion is not to be taken as a cruel death, as I tried to indicate in the talk yesterday with the mathematical symbolism. But it is death. It is a going forth in the experiences of death. The body lies entranced. It is kept alive by his teacher, by the exercise of occult power, and no harm can possibly come to it during the time that the disciple is away in the mysterious process of initiation. There he learns by experience what he had previously been taught. And he goes forth knowing what he is doing. He knows because he has learned, he has been taught. And he must go through realms which are terrifying, because until then, he never even knew what the universe was like. It is more terrifying than the earliest explorers who sailed out on the uncharted oceans. and centuries gone by, setting out to discover new lands. It is a more awesome experience than anything we can possibly imagine. But having gone through it, and not having lost his spiritual integrity, another phase of initiation awaits him. And that is the glorious part wherein he meets his own inner God face to face. He discovers that from within himself he brings forth the blossom, which is himself and was there all the time in potentiality, just as all of us have it. Then coming back from initiation, which incidentally he discovers is only the first of many, he comes back a fully qualified teacher because now he has experienced. And he knows he can teach because of experience, and that is what makes him the qualified teacher. Then, taking the letters of the occult language that he has learned before, he can put the letters into words. He can put the words into sentences. He can create with the sentences. He uses the occult powers because he knows. He understands the laws of life and death. He has complete mastery over himself, which means complete mastery over these laws as well. And he can perform what to us would seem to be wonders. Now, here are some of the things that can be done. And the reason for explaining them is in order to point out to you just what H.P. Blavatsky actually was. She was an initiate, and one of the greatest of the occult powers which is used solely for the benefit of humanity is a power which goes by a Tibetan word, tulku. T-U-L-C-U, tulku. And there are many forms of the tulku, but the aspect of the tulku which interests us this evening, as it applied to H.P. Blavatsky, was this. In the first place, as I think that I mentioned yesterday or Sunday, there was a period of her life when she was in training. And when she returned from Tibet, after those 7 years of training with her teachers, she was not as she was at the time she entered on that period of training. Something had occurred, and it was a great mystery, and it was that which made her what is known as a messenger. Now, I'm sure that all of you are familiar with the word Shambhala as the name of the mystical home of the adepts of wisdom, the masters. The thing that occurs when a messenger is to be sent out into the world is a wonder, a psychological mystery. It is done with the full knowledge and consent of the messenger, but it is also a heavy price to pay, because nothing of this kind is ever accomplished without a price. That is one of the occult laws. The teacher himself pays a heavy price in instructing his pupils. This is something you yourselves can read of in reading H.P. Blavatsky's writings. The little book, Practical Occultism, explains this. It is also explained in the Mahatma Letters. If you'd like to read on page 484 of Mahatma Letters, there's a passage there explaining something of this. But there is an occult law that there is a price to be paid for everything. Now, this price, which must be paid by the messenger, it's a tragedy. Every messenger has a tragedy in his or her life. And that is the explanation of the great tragedy of H.P. Blavatsky's life, and should make us very understanding of her. And when we defend her against her critics and those who would vilify her, it is as well that we defend her with knowledge. A portion of H.P. Blavatsky's psychological constitution was held at Shambhala when she was sent forth into the world. She surrendered a portion of herself. The reason was this. She made of herself a willing and conscious vehicle. And she became what we may call a mediator, which is as different from a medium as a sun is different from a candle. H.P. Blavatsky was not a medium in any sense of the word. She was a mediator. She was a channel, and in this gap, if you like, to use a word, which isn't very good, but in this gap in her constitution, there was the gateway into which could flow the intelligence and the spiritual divine essence, the magnetism of a Mahatman, a teacher. Her own teacher was the Master M, but it was not always the Master M who worked through her at the times that she was teaching. This is the secret of the writing of the Secret Doctrine and others of her works. They were dictated. They were written by the teacher using H.P. Blavatsky's hands, if you like, what was left of her, using this as the medium. Unfortunately, I used the word medium, but not in the same sense. I don't mean a spiritualistic medium. I mean the means used in that sense, as the means by which this work was accomplished. In this sense, many of the Mahatma letters were written. Not all of the Mahatma letters are actually in pen and ink written with the Master's own hand. We might even say that comparatively few of them were, but they were nevertheless the Mahatma letters. They were nevertheless written by the Masters themselves using H.P. Blavatsky as their amanuensis, as their channel. And they were as much written by them as if they had taken pen in hand and written on their own piece of paper. And some of them were so written. Some of them were precipitated by occult means, and that again is another story. But going back to H.P. Blavatsky now, in becoming the messenger and making herself the willing and self-conscious channel, this was done so that the Theosophical Society, the membership, and that means ourselves, would be ensured, or we would be assured, that the right teachings would come from the Mahatmans. We were assured that at least at the start we were given the right teachings, because it was the Masters themselves who gave the teachings through H.P. Blavatsky. Whenever H.P.B. was meeting with her own students and giving the sublime philosophy as the teacher, it was the Master working through her as their channel, as their messenger. Now, the great tragedy in the life of a messenger is this, that she willingly became a psychological cripple. In some respects, she was not responsible for her own acts and her own words. It was the price that she paid. That was the thing that made her so difficult, and she was not always filled with the presence of her teacher. It was never intended that it should be so. And therefore, at the times when she was not so filled, life was extremely difficult for her, much more difficult than it is for us, who have never experienced anything of this kind. And there must have been times when she felt very, very much alone, much more so than we ever do, because we are not psychological cripples in this sense of the word. This is something which happens only occasionally, and for a specific purpose. Occult powers are never played with. They're never used for entertainment. They are used for serious business. And what can be more serious than the bringing of spiritual light and understanding to humanity? It is the most serious work there is. And one of HPB's caliber could and did offer herself on the altar of truth. There is the true meaning of the word sacrifice. She sacrificed herself in the true sense of the word to make sacred. She made herself sacred to the work. She lay her life upon the altar of service. And there is no greater service that anyone can give than to give himself. Now, there is the difference between H.P. Blavatsky and H.P.B. with the three dots after her name. And there is the secret of the difference. When she was H.P. Blavatsky, she was the woman. When she was H.P.B., she was the teacher, in this manner that I've explained. Now, when a messenger of this type dies, then all is restored. There is no permanent inconvenience ever caused in a situation like this. It is purely temporary. And once this life was over, everything was restored to a normal state of affairs. She had the rest that was her due. And we may feel assured that her work goes on. It was only begun. We have in our hands the priceless privilege and responsibility of carrying on her work. And the words that were attributed to her as her last words were, "Keep the link unbroken. Do not let my last incarnation be a failure." And how much more she meant by these words than we understand, until we know something of her. She was the link between the Theosophical Society and the Masters. What did she mean when she said, "Keep the link unbroken"? Was it something that we could treat lightly? Did we even understand what she meant? If we understand now how she was the link, and how the Theosophical movement can and should still carry the energy of the White Lodge, then we can evaluate our work. We can evaluate the work through the years, and we can ask ourselves very honestly and very deeply and very sincerely, have we carried on the tradition? Is our work strictly in line with that laid down by the Masters through H.P. Blavatsky? And it is for each of us to answer in his or her own way if we hope to continue to make ourselves of service in the great work, because the great work goes on. Nothing can stop it. The other aspect of the Tulku that I wanted to touch on, because it again leads us into a very high and lofty theme, and it is one which we should understand better, and I'm sure that you do have some understanding of it, is the doctrine of avatars. And we did touch on it in our talk yesterday in the mathematical symbolism. And in the teaching of avatars, a great and wonderful thing happens. It is one of the greatest feats of white magic that we can conceive of. And it is for the good of the human race, of course. The appearance of the avatar is a great event in human history, but it is not like the reincarnation of ordinary people. An avatar as a feat of white magic is something that occurs once, and this particular avatar can never occur again. There is a strange mystery, and this, as far as I have understood it, is what happens. When an avatar is to come into being at the right cyclic time, and we did learn that once in 2160 years, or the time of the messianic cycle, that is the time for the appearance of an avatar. One of the greatest of the teachers who has become a Nirmanakaya, and that means a lofty spiritual intelligence complete in everything but a physical body, not a dead person in any sense of the word, fully alive. In fact, I would say never sleeping, fully awake and fully alive, complete in every respect except a physical body, knowing that the time has come to produce that wonderful event known as an avatar, selects a body temporarily, selects a body, does not incarnate in the ordinary sense in which we are incarnated. A portion of himself incarnates and helps that body to grow. It would be a body carefully chosen from a family, or in a family, I should say, which would give to it the right psychological apparatus, the right makeup that would serve its purposes, the purposes that have to be carried out. And so there we have two elements, a pure physical body brought up, brought into life, quickened by the intelligence, which is a portion of the nature of a Nirmanakaya, and brought up to manhood. Then a great event happens, a different type of initiation from the one which we have followed in imagination, a different type. But in this initiation, the consciousness of the Nirmanakaya, who himself had been through many initiations previous to this, goes out in this particular type of initiation, which is symbolized at the Christmas time, symbolized in the story of Christ, goes out and makes contact with a waiting divinity, one of the higher beings whom we may call a god. So lofty in its own sphere of activity, its own spiritual and divine evolution, that all our ideas about devas or angels or what you like don't begin to touch it. They're totally and completely inadequate. However, such a divine being, a god, one of the highest beings of the solar system, has a karmic tie with humanity, a karmic tie along spiritual lines. And part of its karma is to make a link with humanity through this Nirmanakaya. And at the conclusion of this initiation, when the resurrection is supposed to have occurred in the story of Jesus, the resurrection is the culmination of this mystery of the avatar. The entranced body arises. And there is a mystical name for one so initiated, because he enshrines not only the intelligence of the Nirmanakaya who has given himself for this purpose, but he also enshrines within himself the mighty flame, the mighty divine spiritual flame of a god. And he carries about himself an essence, a solar essence, and the mystical name is a son of the sun. A son of the sun. The Sanskrit name would be Suryusya Putra, son of the sun. And that was the title, the mystical title given to an initiate. In fact, initiates of many degrees bore this title, son of the sun. And in the case of such a one arising, such an avatar arising successfully from this initiation, it is more than a figure of speech to say that he was radiant. He actually was. This radiance was an actual glow around him, and there was a light above his head, and this light is dimly remembered in religion. It is dimly remembered and represented in the paintings as a halo. Now, the halo actually has a mystical significance, but it is completely forgotten in the religion of today. But there is the real meaning of it. And this, then, is the avatar, a mighty feat of white magic. And when we said that it never occurred again, we mean that particular physical body, that particular Nirmanakaya, that particular divine being whom we may call a god, never before came together in that particular combination and never will again. You see? Now that is the only sense in which we can understand the saying, Christ was the only Son of God. It means simply that this was the only time that this particular avatar appeared in this particular way. But in the course of human history, there are many avatars. And they appear either openly or secretly, openly as Jesus the Christ did, although he was not understood in his time. It is possible to understand more of these things than it was in his day. because the foundation work has been laid by H.P. Blavatsky and her teachings. They have laid the foundation so that it is possible for us to understand these things today. So now, Jory, I think the time has come when we can turn it over to questions.
Gordon, I think we have all deeply appreciated this journey, this entry. I wonder, Gordon, if I may start the questions, and perhaps it will lead on to some others. You and I have already discussed this particular point, but in the light of what you have said this evening, will you comment on that magical date which theosophists so often call up of 1970?
Oh. Well, it is a very good idea to express our thoughts on this, and I find that my thoughts are substantially no different from Joy's, and she tells me that she has herself answered this question in her lecturing, and from that I may deduce that our thoughts are pretty much alike among all of us. But I will tell you what I have been saying when the question has come up, as it has several times during the last weeks, during this trip that my wife and I have been making. And I imagine that the question is going to come up more and more often as this next decade moves along. I say in substance, whereas it is indicated that there is a fresh effort on the part of the White Lodge to stimulate the thought life of the world along spiritual lines. In other words, there is a new spiritual impetus at the end of every century. I am not aware that any promise has been made that a teacher will come in the form of a man or a woman, declare himself to be a teacher, and then take over. No such promise has ever been made. And if we have preconceived ideas about this, we are almost certain to be disappointed. And I think one of the tragedies that could happen, and that which would hamper the work more than anything else, would be for the various either theosophical groups or quasi-mystical groups, of which there are legion, if we should hear many voices clamoring in the wilderness, "We are the ones who have the teacher." That type of thing would discourage the outward appearance of this work more than anything that I can think of. Now, it seems to me that the evidence of the coming into fruition of the spiritual effort toward the end of this century is already with us. It is like the dawn before the sunrise, and the dawn comes so stealthily and so gradually that you cannot point to a specific moment and say, "Well, here it is now. This is the January 1st, 1975. Let's see what's going to happen." But I think that we can see the signs that something is happening already. You have only to read the books that are written today. You have only to study what's going on in the realms of science, in the realms of religion. You'll see that there is a gradual awakening going on all the time. And we can look for an increase in this. But we also have to guard ourselves for increases along other lines, increases along the lines of quasi-mystical societies springing up everywhere, increases in groups which are interested in psychic phenomena, parapsychology, and the like. This is likely to be intensified. Various aspects of human life are likely to quicken their tempo along with all of this. Much of this has to be guarded against. Much of it has to be understood and explained. We have to treat all people kindly and with understanding, but we have to make our position perfectly clear, because we have a very clear position. Now, if it is hoped that the theosophical movement, as we know it today, will embody a teacher, let us remember that the theosophical movement is greater than any society. And whereas the theosophical society broke up into various branch societies, They are all within the theosophical movement to some degree, but I doubt whether any of us in any society that we could name has held absolutely true to the original intent. And I speak as a fellow theosophist, I don't speak as a critic. But if none of the theosophical societies as they exist do not provide the channel that is required, then the White Lodge will certainly work through the theosophical movement, most certainly, because that is their channel, but in another aspect of the theosophical movement. So the question is, do we want to make ourselves of use? The question is not, will this particular society be the vehicle for a new messenger? That isn't the question. The question is, can we put ourselves in such a position that we can be of value? That is the best way that we can approach it. Then we are not building up preconceived ideas, ideas that are likely to result in disappointment. But if every one of us works to raise the tone of the Theosophical Society along the lines of genuine theosophical study, the genuine practice of brotherhood, the genuine living of the theosophical life, even if we never hear of the messenger in 1975, nevertheless, great good will have been accomplished for the Theosophical Society. And that is the greatest thing that could happen. Then we may be sure that whether we know it or not in the terms that we are expecting or that we think it should be, we may be sure that we will be of service and we may be of real value. And I think that is, as I see it, the most sensible approach to the question.
Do you consider, Dr. Palmer, that the spiritual initiations are absolutely essential to reaching the human goal?
To reaching the what?
Human goal or liberation?
Oh, well, yes, I do, definitely. In initiation, the evolutionary course is quickened. Now, if we were to think that they are not essential, then we would have to say the whole human race will achieve, but in the unthinkably distant future, with untold suffering between now and that time. And that is not a very happy prospect. But if this is to be accomplished in such a short time, relatively speaking, that valuable aid can be given to the human race to help relieve the almost unbearable load of suffering, then initiation is absolutely essential. Does that answer your question?
Sure.
Sure.
I want to say some always maintain that Christ was not actually a living entity, but that the whole of the story is to be taken as a symbolism, something that each one of us has to go through, but as a step in evolution.
The idea is not completely wrong. Most certainly it is symbolic of what happens within each one of us. And after all, Christ himself said, greater things than these shall ye do. That, of course, is perfectly true. Nevertheless, there undoubtedly was a man who lived, and he did belong to the occult brotherhood of the Essenes, which was a mystery school of that time. There have been mystery schools in all historic ages, and the Brotherhood of the Essenes was such a mystery school, and he did belong to it. He did travel. Now, as to the actual date of his birth, that certainly is uncertain. And he is not a figure which appears in the history books, nor is he a figure even as understood in the Bible, because you cannot take the Bible literally. But the figure of this man was seized upon as a convenient way of telling a mystery story, in the true sense of the word mystery, a mystery tale, you see? And the value of the story of Christ does not lie in its being the history of a person, because probably it was not the actual record of his life. But this man was seized upon as a type figure. You see what I mean? And so, by all means, the story is to be taken mystically, and it has to be interpreted. The virgin birth has to be interpreted. The miracles have to be interpreted. The healing, you see, the cross, and all of this has to be interpreted as a mystery tale, which may be applied to each one of us individually, may be applied to any avatar who appears on the human scene, may be applied to the human race as a whole. It can be interpreted in various manners. Does that answer your question?
Well, I'm not quite satisfied about this 1975. You were saying that in all probability, the great teacher who is come forth will not take a physical body. Now, it is my understanding, I think from the first book that I had read by a woman who does, that three cycles are coming together at this particular time in history, and therefore, one of the greatest teachers of mankind will come forward, and he will be on a par with a Buddha. And therefore, if he is to be a teacher of humanity, and as you say, if he will not contain a physical form, can you tell me just exactly what nature this great Buddha will take?
Yes, thank you very much. I'm not aware that I said he would not. I merely said it was never promised to us that he would. But that is not saying that he will not. I was trying to steer our thinking away from developing a sense of expectancy that things are going to happen in a way we imagine they should. You see? Now, actually, I have no knowledge as to whether he will appear in a physical body and make himself known as a great teacher, or whether he will not. My own belief is this, that we are coming to a state of mind because of the existence of so many different societies which accentuate the person at the head of the society. I could name a few, but it might not be tactful to, but on the other hand, you may know just what I mean. There is this society recognized by the name of the person who heads it. You see? Well, now we have so much of that, that many people have a built-in resistance to anybody who is going to step forward and proclaim himself to be a great teacher. He would automatically put up our defenses. You see? Now, let us say that such a one actually comes in our midst. He is going to be wise enough to know this. He would not make himself evident on the human scene in a way that is going to arouse opposition. He would know that this opposition is very well founded. He would know human nature well enough so that he could detect our spiritual yearnings. He would understand us well enough so he would know exactly the lines along which he would work to evoke the response from us that he needs. You see? Now, he could do that equally well if he were a Nirmanakaya without any physical body at all, or a human being with no particularly prepossessing appearance, not making a great splash on the human stage, as it were, or whether he were a great world figure. Actually, the details of that might not matter so much. The important thing is, does his work evoke a response from us? Is he wise enough? Is he spiritual enough? Does he see into human nature deeply enough so that he knows the way to work in order to evoke from us the support that he needs? Does that answer the question? And I'm not trying to say too definitely whether he will or whether he will not appear as a teacher, but I would say this, that an event such as we envision for 1975 cannot happen without preparation. And I'm very sure that the preparation is underway now.
Very glad, Gordon. coming back with an expectant
exactly.
attitude.
Yes.
Something will come to us.
That's right.
What can I do?
What can I do is the keynote, yes.
Can you give us any idea of what this preparation would be?
I think that we should look for it in the impressing upon human minds, wherever they are receptive, of greater ideas and giving expression to the greater ideas than we have been accustomed to previously. And I think that if we read, we see that this is coming about. Also, I would say that it could come very markedly as a desire among us, as a group of theosophists. It could come very noticeably as a desire felt by us to understand the teachings better and to fit ourselves to teach. That desire, which appears to be growing, there appears to be a growing need in the Theosophical Society today for the teachings as they were given. Not only as they were given, but also the need to see into the written words, see beyond the written words, and discover that every teaching we have is a window. And the window is clear glass if we will only clear it. If the glass is not clear, it's our fault. But we can clear the glass by our orientation of thinking in the right direction. We can look through the window and see great vistas which are available to us. Another way that I'd like to put it, and I do speak of this often, we discover that the stream of knowledge is absolutely inexhaustible. It will never run dry. And one of the great secrets, as I see it, of theosophical lecturing is never tell all you know. Never let your own stream run dry, your own stream of information. Always withhold something. Now that may sound a little strange. It may sound as if, well, you're just being a little bit selfish with what you know. But actually, no, that isn't so. It's a sort of an inner attitude of keeping the stream flowing. Because every single one of us knows more than we would tell on the public platform anyway. Every one of us does. And if we try to tell everything we know, we are only allowing the stream to run dry. Hold some back as the link, that link within, because every one of us has the link with that stream of knowledge. And it is a wonderful thing for us to realize that stream will never run dry. It's always there. And the awareness of these things, the desire to learn, is in itself part of the preparation. I'm quite convinced of that. I hope that answers your question.